Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and you're joining me for a deep dive into Friday the 13th. Welcome back to Hitchens on Horror, my friends. It's been a while, and I'm glad you've joined me again at the Witching Hour. This is the third season of this podcast. If you haven't listened to the first two seasons, I highly recommend you go back and do so if you like. The first season was called 62 Horror Movies, in which I discussed every day in the month of October, two of my favorite horror movies. Usually those two movies are connected by a theme, because I simply could not choose just 31 favorite horror movies. It just was not possible. So I did 62. The second season of this Hitchens on Horror podcast is called 12 Nights of Terror. When I discuss for 12 nights leading up to Christmas Day, some of my favorite holiday-themed horror movies. Sometimes just one movie, sometimes there's two in a double feature. I really enjoyed doing that series, very proud of it, so I hope you can check it out. For this third season, we are going to do a deep dive into the Friday the 13th movies. Friday the 13th is my favorite out of the big three slasher franchises from the 1980s, the other two being Halloween and A Nightmare on Elm Street, of course. I do really like the Halloween franchise and Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, but I think they both have their issues in different ways, but I have always believed, and I hope by the end of this season that maybe some of you will agree with me, that Friday the 13th is the best franchise out of those three. It's the most consistent for me and the most fun. The Halloween franchise notoriously has been retconned and rebooted a million times by now. And the Nightmare on Elm Street series, I think, descended into self-parody in a way that I don't necessarily enjoy, but a lot of people do, and good for them. But the Friday the 13th series, I think, is remarkably consistent and fun and innovative as it goes on. So we are going to spend the next 8 weeks going over the first 8 movies in the Friday the 13th series. Because for me, the first 8 movies, beginning with Friday the 13th in 1980 and ending with Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan in 1989, for me, that's the real Friday the 13th. There were other movies made in the 90s and early 2000s, but they were made by New Line Cinema after Paramount Pictures sold the rights to the character of Jason Voorhees to that studio, and to me, they just don't have the same feel. I think they're bad movies, quite honestly, and not bad in a fun way, as some of the Friday the 13th movies of the 80s are. And I think the series really encapsulates the slasher genre of the 80s very well, and I think really kind of perfected it. Of course, we have the antecedents, you know, even going back to Psycho in 1960, Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974, also Black Christmas, and of course, Halloween. And all those movies are masterpieces, works of art. Friday the 13th, I think, stole the best ingredients of all of those films and created a formula that I think perfected what we now think of as the slasher movie genre, one that would be imitated and copied millions of times over to various degrees of success. But I think Friday the 13th, especially the first movie, doesn't get its due. I actually think the first Friday the 13th, which we're going to be discussing tonight, is one of the greatest slasher movies of the 80s, and I'll be talking about why, and maybe by the end you'll agree with me. This season for Hitchens on Horror, we're going to do things a little bit differently than we have in the past. For the first two seasons, I would do sort of an introduction to the movie and then tell you to watch the movie. And then after the movie is over, come back and I would sort of do a coda with some more trivia and information. But with the Friday the 13th movies, we're going to do things a bit differently in that because I imagine that there are some folks out there listening who may not have seen these movies before or may not have seen all these movies before. And in talking about the history and details of the making of these movies, the story behind the film, it's hard to talk about that without using spoilers, especially for the first one. So we're really going to do this as a traditional horror host experience. We are going to watch these movies together. I invite you to watch along with me. I will do an introduction to each film. Then we're going to start watching the movie, and I will tell you at the timestamp to press pause on the movie, and I'll talk about things. We'll take a few breaks throughout the movie and then talk at the end. You can find all eight of the original Friday the 13th movies now streaming on Paramount Plus because all the streaming services are merging now, as I'm sure you all know. And Paramount Plus has merged with Showtime, and Showtime has all the Friday the 13th movies. So that is where you can find them. That is where I will be watching them. And I hope you enjoy taking this 8-week journey into the realm of Camp Blood with me. I think we're going to have a lot of fun along the way. And we're going to start by talking about the movie that began it all, Friday the 13th, released in 1980, written by Victor Miller and directed by Sean S. Cunningham, who also produced the film. So, to begin the story of the Friday the 13th series, it really does all begin with writer, producer, director Sean S. Cunningham, bless him. So, Sean S. Cunningham became a filmmaker in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And the way he broke into the filmmaking business was making what people called back then marital aid films, basically polite name for softcore porn. Two of those movies were pretty successful. One he made was called The Art of Marriage, very classy title. And another movie he made was called Together, which husbands and wives or boyfriends and girlfriends were supposed to go see together and learn how to enrich their bedroom life. Now, Together is important in the genesis of our story because the editor on the movie Together was a guy named Wes Craven. That's how Sean S. Cunningham met Wes Craven. And after they made Together, Sean S. Cunningham decided to produce Wes Craven's first movie he wrote, directed, and edited, a movie that was released in 1972. It is The Last House on the Left, which if you have not seen The Last House on the Left, as a fan of horror movies, if you are, and if you aren't, I don't know why you're here, it's one of those movies that every horror fan should watch at least once. It is a very, very brutal movie. I would, you know, look up the summary, plot summary on Wikipedia before you watch it, just so you know what you're getting into. It's not a movie that I love at all, but it's a movie I respect. And it really is, along with Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974, I think really announced a new era in horror filmmaking that was, you know, much more brutally honest and depicting really the darkest underside of American culture. It has immense historical value, Last House on the Left does. Now, they made the movie for $90,000. It grossed $3 million, even though critics hated it, but audiences really did enjoy it. And Last House on the Left had the famous ad campaign, to keep yourself from fainting, just keep repeating, it's only a movie, it's only a movie. After Last House on the Left, Sean S. Cunningham directed another movie, a sort of sexploitation murder mystery, called The Case of the Full Moon Murders, also known as The Case of the Smiling Stiffs, in which there's a serial killer who might be a vampire who leaves his victims smiling and sexually aroused. Stars a lot of the people who were involved in The Last House on the Left, but also stars Harry Reams, who of course is most famous for being the leading actor in the movie that ushered in the whole porno chic brief era in the 70s, Deep Throat. It sounds like a hoot, actually, that movie. I kind of want to seek it out. It sounds wild. But after that, Sean S. Cunningham wanted to try a different direction, wanted to try a different way to break into film. And so he made two movies that were the complete opposite of, you know, the softcore porn and the brutal horror of Last House on the Left. He made two movies that were super, super wholesome. Both released in 1978. They are called Here Come the Tigers and Manny's Orphans. And both movies are pretty similar in that they star basically a cast of young children involved in sports and eventually triumphing over adversity and being very cute. They were very cheap to make, and they made a profit, but not really. And Sean S. Cunningham, after that, was like, what do I do? What is the next thing? How do I really break into this business? And then, later that year, in 1978, a little movie came out called Halloween, written and directed by John Carpenter. And Sean S. Cunningham saw how much money Halloween made and what a phenomenon it became. And he called his friend, a writer named Victor Miller, Victor Miller also wrote Here Come the Tigers and Manny's Orphans. Cunningham called Victor Miller, and according to Victor Miller's recollection, Sean S. Cunningham said to him over the phone, "Hey, Halloween's making a lot of money. How about we rip it off?" And that is how Friday the 13th was born. Sean S. Cunningham hired Victor Miller to write the script and also brought along Steve Miner as a producer as well. Cunningham and Miller had worked with Steve Miner before on movies, and Steve Miner will continue to be a very large presence in the next few weeks, as we'll talk about. So the idea for this movie, they wanted to make it cheap, they wanted to make it quick, and the idea was initially, okay, we've got to find a setting, we've got to find a place where some teenagers can be that's isolated, where they won't have adults to help them, and they eventually hit upon the idea of a summer camp. And Victor Miller wrote a treatment, script treatment, that he entitled Long Night at Camp Blood, which is a title I actually quite love and describes what the movie and the story is very, very well. But Sean S. Cunningham became really obsessed with the idea of a title called Friday the 13th. Again, we'd already had Black Christmas, we had Halloween, so he wanted Friday the 13th to sort of continue in that way of being a holiday or a date that everyone knew, that everyone would be familiar with, and Friday the 13th, of course, being known as a very unlucky day. So to test this concept, Sean S. Cunningham took out a full-page ad in Variety magazine and at the top it said, "From the producer of The Last House on the Left, the most terrifying movie ever made." And then it had big logo Friday the 13th breaking through and shattering glass, which is, again, as a superstition, it's bad luck to break a mirror. They didn't have any financing at this point. They barely had a script, but Sean S. Cunningham wanted to see if it would work, if it would get people interested in the movie, even though it did not even exist yet. And it did work. They got producers interested, and They were on their way to making Friday the 13th. The budget for the movie was $550,000, was what it ended up being. And they really, one of the virtues of the first Friday the 13th, I think, is in its casting. The casting agency that Cunningham worked with to cast Friday the 13th was a casting agency located in New York that was primarily known for doing casting for Broadway and off-Broadway theater. But the casting agency wanted to break into doing film as well. And so Friday the 13th was a movie they cast. And the result was they got really great actors to play these characters of these eight teenagers who were killed one by one. Victor Miller said a really fun thing about writing the script and the casting. He said, "You have to find as many ways as you can to make the teenagers dumb without being really stupid." And Sean S. Cunningham, in looking for the actors to play these parts, wasn't really interested in them having to be great actors. They just had to be likable. They had to look like they could be camp counselors realistically, that they could read the lines in a convincing way, the kind of kids that look like they could be in a Pepsi commercial, is the way he put it. Now, originally, for the main role of Alice, Cunningham and the producers really wanted Sally Field to play the part. Sally Field had just won the Oscar for Best Actress in 1979 for Norma Rae. We'll have an Oscar-winning actress as the lead in this movie. That'll bring people in. But they also quickly realized that they would never in the world be able to afford an actress of Sally Field's caliber for the film, so they decided to go with an unknown actor. And the actor that they cast in the role of Alice is Adrienne King, who is simply wonderful in this film. She came to the audition call. She was the last one that day to audition. And after she auditioned, Sean S. Cunningham said to her, "Well, they save the best actress for last." And then they asked her to scream for them. And her amazing scream clinched it. She got the role. She's wonderful. You also have Laurie Bartram playing the role of Brenda. Laurie Bartram was an actor, but primarily a ballet dancer. Didn't do that much film, but she did do a lot of directing and choreographing for theater after this. Also in the movie, you have Harry Crosby, who's playing Bill. Harry Crosby is the son of the singer Bing Crosby. And Bing Crosby had actually died shortly before filming began on Friday the 13th. And cast members later recalled that, you know, he would, in between shots and at night, he would tell them all stories about his dad. Harry Crosby eventually left acting to be an investment banker. But good for him, I guess. But he's fun in this movie. Then we have three other actors. A guy that you may have heard of by the name of Kevin Bacon as Jack, Mark Nelson as Ned, and Janine Taylor as Marcy. And all three actors, again, worked in New York theater, worked in soap operas, as daytime soap operas as well. But the three of them actually already knew each other and were friends. And the producers and Cunningham thought that that was perfect because in the movie, Jack, Ned, and Marcy are very close and they already have that existing dynamic between them. Mark Nelson, when he auditioned, he was given very comedic scenes to read, which confused him because he was like, okay, I'm a dramatic actor. And then for his second audition, they asked him to audition wearing a bathing suit, which caused him to wonder, like, what kind of movie is this? Is this a porn? Which is, you know, a fair question, considering that Sean S. Cunningham had directed quite a bit of that. But he got the part. Mark Nelson as Ned is important because the character of Ned in the first Friday the 13th is really the first time in a slasher movie where you have a character who has that archetype of like the funny guy or the practical joker type. Black Christmas doesn't have a character like that. Halloween doesn't have a character like that. It's not until Friday the 13th that you get that character archetype that is copied and was and still is copied again and again in slasher movies to this day. But Mark Nelson as Ned is the first. Mark Nelson has gone on to have an extremely amazing and respectable career in theater. He's been on Broadway many, many times, was in Angels in America, was in the original production of Amadeus, A Few Good Men. He's done Shakespeare at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C., playing Shylock. He teaches acting at Princeton University and studied acting under the legendary acting teacher Uta Hagen. So it's really amazing to watch Mark Nelson as Ned in this movie and then think about where he's gone on since. You also have Robbie Morgan in this film as Annie, who actually wasn't going to audition for this movie at all. She was auditioning for another film. She happened to walk into the casting director's office, and the casting director looked at her and said, "You're a camp counselor." And that's how she got the part of Annie in Friday the 13th. We have Peter Brower as Steve Christie, the owner of the camp. Now, originally, the producers, similarly to Alice, wanted a big-name actor for the role of Steve Christie, but again, quickly realized that they didn't have the budget for that. Peter Brower's girlfriend was actually the assistant director on Friday the 13th, assisting Sean S. Cunningham, so he asked her if there were any openings. And Sean S. Cunningham came to visit his assistant director at home one day and saw Peter Brower gardening outside of the house and was like, "That's Steve Christie." That's how he got the role. So that's our great cast. Friday the 13th was filmed in September of 1979 in Warren County, New Jersey, primarily in the towns of Blairstown, Hardwick, and Hope. And they actually filmed the movie at a working Boy Scout camp called Camp Nobi Bosco, which still exists today, is still a Boy Scout camp, and they do have, of course, Friday the 13th tours and events sometimes as well. Now, I think the fact that they filmed this movie on the East Coast in New Jersey and at a working Boy Scout camp that had been open since the mid-1920s is a huge, huge part of why the first Friday the 13th is so successful, because it feels real. They're not sets. All the buildings are real. The rooms are real. Look like they've been in use for decades. So it gives the movie almost a documentary feel at times, which I think goes a long, long way to making it work. And once the Friday the 13th movies started being filmed around Los Angeles, I think they lost a little something, but that's for later on. Now, we also have to talk about the incredible special makeup effects in this film that were done by the legendary Tom Savini. Sean S. Cunningham really wanted Tom Savini to do the makeup gore effects for this film after seeing his work in Dawn of the Dead, which came out in 1978. Tom Savini was a combat photographer in Vietnam during the war. And then once he got back, then started going into special effects makeup. And he said, like, if the makeup did not match what he had seen in real life, then it wasn't good enough. I think that is part of why he's such a brilliant, brilliant special effects makeup artist. Sadly, some of his work was a little too much for the MPAA when this movie came out. about 11 seconds of gore footage had to be excised from this movie for it to get an R rating. But the unrated version of the movie is out there. It's not streaming, but if you have it on, if you buy this on DVD or Blu-ray, they usually have the unrated version. It's worth checking out. And of course, the music. The music is a hugely iconic piece of Friday the 13th, done by Henry Manfredini. And for this film, for the first Friday the 13th, he made a rule. He wanted the music only to be present when the killer was actually there. Because in contrast to Halloween, because of course in Halloween, there's music all over the place, and it's brilliant, and is a huge, huge reason why that film is as successful as it is as well. Henry Manfredini wanted to do something different for Friday the 13th, you know, sort of taking, he took inspiration from Jaws, where even though you don't see the shark, when you hear the music, you know the shark is around, and he did that exact same thing in Friday the 13th, and did it brilliantly. All right. I've talked long enough. That is our introduction to this film. Now, for each Friday the 13th movie, I'm going to do a body count and the methods of which the victims are dispatched. So, in Friday the 13th, we have 11 murders. 11 people die in this movie. Well, it's really 10 people die and one snake. I should say that now at the very beginning. There is a snake that is chopped up in this movie by a machete, and the snake was real, and the snake was really killed on screen. And people were very upset about that, especially the snake handler, who was not informed that the snake was going to be killed, and they actually had to restrain him from beating the shit out of Sean S. Cunningham after they killed his snake. They should have let him beat the shit out of Sean S. Cunningham for that. So, warning, the snake does die, my friends. But other than the snake, we have murders by knife to the stomach. We have multiple throat slitting. We have an arrow through the neck. We've got an axe to the face and decapitation. And I give the first Friday the 13th movie 4 machetes. My highest rating of 4 machetes. We'll see how the rest of the movies in the series stack up to it. So, my friends, we're going to watch Friday the 13th together. I hope you got your popcorn ready. Cue up the movie. Now, when the movie gets to about 22 minutes and 30 seconds, I want you to pause and we'll come back. And when that 22 minutes, 30 seconds happens, you're going to see something very bad happen to someone against a tree, and then the screen is going to fade to white. See you then. All right, my friends, we are at our first break. Okay, so the way this movie begins, I think, is absolutely terrific in setting up its atmosphere. We begin, the first shot of the movie is, again, a full moon against a dark sky, and we are at Camp Crystal Lake back in 1958. And this movie uses the idea of the camera being the killer's point of view, because we're not going to see the killer until the last 15 minutes of the movie, at least not see the killer's face anyway. And I think it's a really great choice that with this killer camera POV, you see the killer going into a cabin that has lots of sleeping little children in their beds. And I love that because I think it sets up an air of danger right from the very beginning. Like, oh my God, are these little kids going to be slaughtered? And they're not. But I think it's a great, way to start. Now, for anyone who has ever attended summer camp or Boy Scout or Girl Scout camp, or camp of any kind, I think this movie does such a great job of taking you back to that childhood experience, you know, singing songs around a fire, things like that. And you hear these familiar songs being sung, like Michael Rowe, The Boat Ashore. But the song that they they start singing as the boy and girl camp counselors start to sneak off away from the group to have sex in the attic is Tom Dooley, which again is a song that everyone has sung around the campfire when they were a kid, probably. But it's interesting because the lyrics of Tom Dooley, if you remember, like it's hang down your head, Tom Dooley, hang down your head and cry, hang down your head, Tom Dooley, poor boy, you're going to die. Which the boy who sneaks away is about to die. But then there's another verse of Tom Dooley that I had actually forgotten about till I looked it up. There's a verse that goes, I met her on the mountain, there I took her life, met her on the mountain, stabbed her with my knife. And the knife is the murder weapon that is about to be used to kill both the boy and the girl. I think that's a brilliant, really subtle touch to begin this movie. I'm sure it must have been intentional. And if it was an accident, I hope the writer and director never admit it, because it's great setup. And we have the opening credits. I love that this movie uses, at several very key moments, a fade to white instead of a fade to black. I think it's really, really effective. And again, you have these great opening credits with the Friday the 13th, you know, coming on and smashing through glass. Shout out also to Barry Abrams, who's the director of photography on this movie. Does a terrific job, and I'll be praising his work as we go along. And after the opening credits, then we're into the movie proper, and we know it's Friday, June 13th, and it's the present. And I love that it says the present, because it sets it now. Whenever you're watching the movie, it is now. Now, of course, looking at the aesthetics of the movie and what people are wearing and what their hair is, we know it's not really now. It is clearly very of its time. The first Friday the 13th movie is set in 1979. And that's important because as we go throughout these movies, we're going to be talking about the year that each movie is set, because the movies very, very quickly start to be set in the future of when they came out. But we'll get more into that. And we start, you know, the present day section of the movie by following the character of Annie, who is hitchhiking her way to Camp Crystal Lake, where she's going to be a cook. I love the scene when she goes into the diner and's like, hey, how far is it to Camp Crystal Lake? And it's literally like a record scratch, like everything stops and everyone looks at her. And it's a great introduction to the mythology. It's like, they call that place Camp Blood. And we also introduce the great character of Crazy Ralph, wonderfully played by Walt Gorney, who, you know, just is absolutely perfect. It's like, you'll never come back again. It's got a death curse. Like, just the way he says his dialogue is just amazing. And we have Annie hitches a ride with a truck driver named Enos. Almost Anus, but no, it's Enos. What a name. So Rex Everhart plays Enos, the truck driver. Also, you know, respected Broadway theater and musical actor. He was the understudy for Ben Franklin in the original production of the musical 1776. And if you listen to the original cast recording, you hear Rex Everhart as Ben Franklin, because Howard Da Silva had a stroke or heart attack, and couldn't perform. Rex Everhart was also the voice of Maurice, Belle's father, in Disney's Beauty and the Beast in 1991. So a little bit of fun trivia for you there. He's wonderful as this sort of brusque sexist truck drivers, like, are all the counselors gonna be as pretty as you? And I love the little detail of, you know, as he hoists Annie up into her seat in the truck, just plants two hands just full on her ass to cop a feel as he pushes her up. And interestingly, the conversation that Enos and Annie have in the truck, Rex Everhart and the actor who played Annie, Robbie Morgan, weren't actually in the truck together during that scene. They each filmed those scenes separately, and it's edited together in a really good way. They were saying their lines to an assistant director during that scene. And Friday the 13th does really well what I think the best haunted house movies do really well, and that it sets up the mythology of Camp Crystal Lake almost immediately. You get the history of, you know, that they call it Camp Blood. It's got a death curse, that there was a boy who drowned in 1957, two counselors killed in 1958. There were fires, the water was bad, it's been abandoned, no one goes there. Possibly haunted, sets you up for where you're going immediately, and that's great. And I love Annie's line when she's like, "Well, at least I'm not afraid of ghosts." Nervous laughter. And I love that. I think it's a brilliant choice that when Enos drops Annie off, he drops her off at a cemetery, which is significant because she's not going to live much longer. And I love that the cemetery is in a town named Hope. If you can look at the, you can see the sign when she's dropped off in the shot, because there's no hope for Annie. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but if not, it's a very happy accident, a nice little bit of foreshadowing. And I love when we have the other characters, Jack, Ned, and Marcy, who are arriving at Camp Crystal Lake. When you first see the Camp Crystal Lake sign, the camera lingers on the sign for a long time. It says, you know, "Welcome to Camp Crystal Lake, established 1935. But what you'll also notice, if you look for it, there's a totem pole to the left of the sign. And on the totem pole, one of the faces looks like it is screaming, wide-eyed, big open mouth screaming, which again is a nice bit of foreshadowing. Again, don't know if that totem pole was put there for the production or if it existed, but it's a nice little bit of the terror to come. And we're introduced to Steve Christie wearing his red hanky, which means something very specific in my community. Look up gay hanky coat. And we also meet Alice, played by Adrienne King. And I love Alice as a character. A lot of people, you know, she invites a lot of comparison to Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. But I think Alice is a very different character. Laurie Strode is so, so vulnerable as a person, and such a sort of goody-two-shoes loner. And Alice is actually quite different. Adrienne King made up a whole backstory for her, that she was in college an art major, psychology minor, was taking a summer off to work at this camp, and then got involved in some sort of romantic relationship with her boss, Steve Christie, that she's debating about whether or not to continue. Alice is, I think, a much stronger character than Laurie Strode, which I love. There's a great, great scare in this section where Brenda is on the archery range and then an arrow is shot and, you know, ends in the target right next to her. It's such a great scare, and you'll notice there's no music during it, and that was very intentional by composer Harry Manfredini, because again, he wanted music only when the killer is actually present. So that scare happens without any music, which I love. And that the person who shot that arrow was actually Tom Savini, who did the special effects, because it was so dangerous. So he did it himself. And then we have Steve leaves these teenagers alone at the camp, goes off in his Jeep. And it's very interesting because we find out that the killer, whoever that is also riding in a Jeep, just with the top up instead of down. And it's interesting because it's actually the same Jeep, Steve and the killer. It's the same vehicle. in the movie, which was, you know, I'm sure for budget. But it also, I think, sets up, makes you wonder, because Steve is absent for quite a while, is Steve actually the killer? And, of course, we say goodbye to Annie with that amazing first kill in our present day timeline, that throat slit where the knife goes, and just for a second nothing happens, and then the blood just starts spurting out, and it's even, that shot's even longer in the unrated version. Great work by Tom Savini there. A lot of people have said that Friday the 13th is a ripoff of Halloween, and in some cases it is, of course, borrowed things. But for me, I think this movie is really haunted by Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, and takes a lot of things from Psycho at specific times and echoes them, but also inverts them. And I think one of the things that Friday the 13th takes from Psycho is with the way they use the character Annie. Because in the present day, Annie is the very first character that we, the audience, meet. She's on her way to Camp Crystal Lake as we are on our way to Camp Crystal Lake. And the movie kind of sets it up that she's going to be the main character that you follow, but then she gets killed at the 22 minutes into the movie. And then you're like, ooh, what's happening now? Sort of unsettles you a bit. And I love that. And we'll talk more about some echoes of Psycho as we go on. All right, my friends, it's time to get back to the movie. Now, once the movie reaches 46 minutes and 50 seconds, you're going to hit pause, and we're going to come back. And what you're going to see at that 46 minutes and 50 seconds, you're going to see an overhead light that is swinging. That's the image that you're going to pause at. All right, see you in a bit, my friends. And Friday the 13th has many, many gifts to give its audience, including the sight of young, very young in his prime, Kevin Bacon in a Speedo. God bless you, costume designer. Now, this is something that the Friday the 13th series would subsequently become criticized for, is a lot of its female nudity, of which you'll notice as this movie goes on, there is almost none. There's actually more nudity in Halloween than there is in the first Friday the 13th. But the Friday the 13th movies, starting with this one and maintaining throughout, always cast very, very attractive actors as its teenagers who are about to be slaughtered. And because we're at a summer camp, it's hot out, they're, you know, usually in various stages of undress, shirtless, or in swimsuits, and there's eye candy for everyone, no matter what your orientation is or what you're interested in. The Friday the 13th series gives everybody some nice humans to look at. I love that when Brenda and Kevin Bacon's character, or you forget his name, but when they go to rescue Ned, who they think is drowning, I love that, you know, you see them running across this dock, like full on like Baywatch lifeguard mode, and Brenda jumps perfectly into the water, you know, tell she worked as a lifeguard at some point in her life, and then Kevin Bacon jumps into the water and totally belly flops into the water. If you look closely, you can see that, like, just fully lands, like, does not dive, just lands fully lands into the water. My God, that must have been painful. I think that's just such a hilarious little moment, if you look at it. And then we have, of course, the snake scene, rest in peace, that I talked about before, was not actually in the original script. It was actually inspired by an incident that Tom Savini had during the filming of the movie. Because most of the actors stayed in a hotel. They didn't stay at the camp. But Tom Savini and his makeup assistant did actually live at the camp in the cabins for the duration of the filming. And there was an instance when Savini found a snake in his cabin and decided that, hey, Sean S. Cunningham, this would be a great thing to put into the movie. And they did. But sadly, they killed the snake. And because the scene was not in the script, it is pretty much all improvised. These lines weren't actually written, which once you know that, becomes really obvious. My favorite exchange in this scene is, Alice says to Bill, "Haven't you ever been in the woods?" And Bill says, "We're not in the woods," when they literally are in the woods, in this summer camp. And then at the end of the scene, there's a cute moment that kind of rescues the scene from being sad for the snake. Marcy says, "At least we know what's for dinner." And they literally hit, the other characters literally hit Marcy with a pill and go, "Aw, Marcy." And I think this is another really key reason why the first Friday the 13th is great. Because these characters, all these characters, these teenagers at the camp, you like all of them. Not a single one of them is annoying or unpleasant or mean. They're all just really likable people. And that is... becomes not true in a lot of slasher movies and in this series also. There's always, you get characters who are just like, "Oh, I'm glad to see that asshole, you know, get his head chopped off," or whatever. But that's not the case in the first Friday the 13th. They're all, you like all of them and you care about all of them. It's fun to watch the scenes with them. They have fun together. You can tell the actors were having fun together as well. I also love the one shot, the very end of that scene where Bill, who has killed the snake with the machete, there's a single shot where he's looking down at the snake with a machete over his shoulder, and it looks quite ominous. And again, you know, same thing with Steve driving a Jeep just like the killer does. I think Bill with a machete was probably... trying to misdirect people that maybe Bill could be the killer, because you don't see a lot of Bill on the first part of the movie. Not sure how successful that red herring is, but I think it's there. The fun scene with the cop, again, also, like the snake thing, was not in the original script written by Victor Miller. So a man named Ron Kurtz, who is going to become important to the Friday the 13th saga as we go on, was hired by Sean S. Cunningham to do some uncredited rewrites on Victor Miller's script. And this scene with the cop encountering the counselors is one of them. And it's the only one that Victor Miller really hated. He hates this scene because his whole conceit for Friday the 13th is that Camp Crystal Lake was supposed to be very isolated, you know, a place where, like, the police or adults would not be able to help them. And the cop just sort of sliding on by negates all that. But it's a really fun scene. And the cop, whose name is Officer Dorf, is played by an actor named Ron Milkey, who just is wonderful and, you know, trying to be talk hip like the kids, like grass, the weed, dig it. He rides a motorcycle, Officer Dorf does. And the actor Ron Milkey did not know how to ride a motorcycle, had never ridden a motorcycle before. And in one of the scenes they filmed it, he fell off the motorcycle on his ass, to use his words. And the motorcycle landed on top of him and everyone came rushing over. Said, "Are you okay?" And he was okay. They filmed it again. But it's really fun to rewind and watch that and watch his departure again, because knowing that he doesn't know how to ride a motorcycle, watching him leave on the motorcycle, you can totally tell that motorcycle is wobbly as fuck. He's barely staying on it. He can't go keep a straight line, wiggling all over the place on that bike. It's really, really funny. I do love, he gets another really great line, like, "We're not gonna stand for any weirdness out here." which is great. And then we have Crazy Ralph again. Yay, Crazy Ralph. I love that reveal of him. He's hiding in the pantry, and they open the door, and there he is. I'm a messenger of God. And Crazy Ralph, I think also Sean S. Cunningham has said, was supposed to be another potential red herring, that Crazy Ralph could also be the killer. But there's a big problem with that, and that Crazy Ralph, we clearly see, is riding a bike, and we know by this point that the killer rides in a Jeep, so it can't be Crazy Ralph. I love that we introduce an emergency generator. I'm like, ooh, I bet that's going to become important in the plot later, which it does. Now, I talked a bit, again, praising the director of photography of this movie. Again, I think another reason why this movie is really successful is that it does a great job with showing us the passage of time during as the day turns into the night. You see the sky get darker. It's not, you know, that they film just all full daylight and then suddenly it's night. No, you see it get to be afternoon and then twilight and then dark. And then just as the sun is setting, a big thunderstorm happens. And there's these really evocative shots of big waves on the lake and the wind. And that infamous classic castle thunder sound effect. Just really, really well done. The atmosphere of this. I love it. I love Marcy's monologue that she has about the dream with the rain turning into blood and the blood washing away in little rivers. And that dream monologue is actually the monologue that all the actresses who auditioned for Friday the 13th were required to say. But again, is another nice bit of foreshadowing. Love that the characters play strip Monopoly. Again, it's really fun to watch these people. And again, Alice ain't Laurie Strode. You know, she's all into it. Then we have a sex scene between Marcy and Kevin Bacon. And the actress who played Marcy was incredibly, incredibly nervous about filming this sex scene. So, and Kevin Bacon saw that she was nervous. So before they filmed it, Kevin Bacon took her aside and they smoked a really fat joint together. And then she was relaxed and she was fine. And you actually get a brief shot of Kevin Bacon's butt, during that sex scene, and you barely see any nudity from Marcy at all. So I think that's nice. And it's a great reveal of seeing Ned dead in the top bunk with his throat slit while they're having sex. You know, you don't see that coming. After they're done having sex, Marcy says, "You are so fine." It's like, yeah, you're speaking for us all, Marcy. And then she leaves to go to the bathroom. And again, that's one of those wonderful, I think, callbacks to anyone who's ever stayed at a campground of any kind. Like, oh, you're in your tent or your cabin. It's like, oh, now I got to trudge out in the rain to this other building where the bathrooms are. And God knows how unclean it's going to be. And the killing of Kevin Bacon is so, so great. The arrow through the neck. And it's really fun the way they did it. So what they did was they made Tom Savini and his assistant made a cast of Kevin Bacon's neck and chest, and rigged up tubing with blood to be pumped through it when the arrow went through the fake neck. The only part of Kevin Bacon that is real during that shot is his actual head. He's actually kneeling on his knees under the bed with his head poking up. Very, very uncomfortable. Had to be that way for a long time while the shot was being set up. They finally go to do the shot and it goes wrong. The tubing connected with the blood, got slightly disconnected, and they knew that they had to get this right or else it was going to take hours to make another form, set it all up again. So Tom Savini's assistant grabbed the blood and the tubing and blew into the tube as hard as he could, which is why when the arrow goes through Kevin Bacon's neck, you get that great arterial spurt of blood. That is totally an accident. It was because Tom Savini's assistant was trying to save the shot, and he did, and he made it even better. And then, of course, poor Marcy is the next to die. It's interesting because we've got three murder, you know, we're halfway through the film now, and we get three murders in very quick succession. We see that Ned is dead. We get a close-up of his slit throat. We get the arrow through the neck with Kevin Bacon. And then Marcy gets an axe to the face. All three very graphic kills. So it halfway through the movie tells you, like, this movie is not fucking around with the kills and the gore. They're going there. And this is another, this scene, the scene where Marcy's killed with the axe, is another way that this movie's haunted by Psycho. Because and this was Tom Savini's idea, that the killer raises the axe, and then the axe hits the overhead light above Marcy, causing the light to swing. And Savini's reasoning was that, you know, they'll see the axe make connection with the light, and subconsciously, like, oh, that's a real axe. So then the kill of Marcy becomes even more believable. But after you get that axe to the face, which again, that shot is longer in the unrated version, there's that overhead light that is swinging. And it's a complete echo of the scene near the end of Psycho, where Lila Crane, played by Vera Miles, encounters the corpse of Mrs. Bates and screams and throws her arm back, and her arm hits the overhead light bulb, causing it to swing and make shadows. It's entirely the same shot. So good. My friends, we're going to get back to the movie when we get to 1 hour and 4 minutes into the film, when Steve Christie makes a surprise Pikachu face. We're going to come back halfway through So Many More to Die. All right, we're back, my friends. Oh, Brenda, you're having a perfectly good time playing Strip Monopoly with Bill and Alice. And then she says, I think I left the windows in my cabin open. And, like, you can just imagine the whole audience in the theater screaming, no, don't go to your cabin. That's a mistake. You know she's doomed from that point on. I love the little, even though nothing really happens in it, I love the little scene with Steve, who, again, where has he been all this time? Steve at the diner, and if you look closely at the menus actually say Blairstown Diner, and Blairstown Diner, where they filmed this, is still open for business today. You can go see it in Blairstown, New Jersey. I really actually want to go sometime. And cheers to Sally Ann Golden, who plays Sandy the waitress in this scene. She's a delight. I wish there was more of her in this movie. Like, he's like, what do I owe you? A night on the town. I would love a whole movie about her. When going back to Brenda, she decides to go take a shower in the bathroom building where we now have just seen Marcy get an axe to the face. And I think this is a really smart moment, because you're expecting Brenda to be killed there. But Brenda hears something. She's like, something's off. She looks back at where the showers are, the curtain's in a different place. And then she's like, no, I'm out of here. Fuck this. And she leaves and goes back to her cabin. She's been smart. But then I also love that after Marcy leaves that scene, then it the camera goes back and there's a shot of the shower that she was just looking at, and the overhead light is swinging again. So you know that the killer has just left to follow her. And I think that's just a really simple and at the same time very eloquent piece of visual storytelling there. I love the sequence that follows that, where Brenda's getting ready for bed. She's in her white nightgown, which is a little granny-ish, but whatever. And then she hears the voice of a young child outside in the rain and the dark, saying, "Help me, help me." And I think that's really interesting because, you know, going back to the beginning of the film, you know, there's this potential suggestion that Camp Crystal Lake is haunted, perhaps haunted by the ghost of the little boy who drowned in the lake. And the fact that Brenda hears that and then goes out into the woods to follow it, and she keeps hearing it, I think is interesting. And given where the movie goes at the end, like, it makes you wonder, like, is it the killer doing this voice, imitating the voice of a child? Or is this actually a ghost? Is it the boy who drowned? We don't know. It's never answered. And I think this is a really effective sequence where Brenda's running around through the woods following this voice in the pouring rain, in the dark, and these scenes are only lit by her flashlight, which I think is really creepy. Remember, though, that this movie was not filmed during the summertime. This movie was filmed in September of 1979, and you can tell, especially when she gets to the archery range, you can tell how cold the actor playing Brenda is just by her body language. She's so tense. You can tell she was fucking freezing by that point. And I think it's interesting that, again, after these, you know, three murders in succession, we don't actually see Brenda get killed. You know, the camera cuts away and we just hear a scream in the distance, which I think is a really interesting thing, because Friday the 13th would later become notorious for its very, very graphic and numerous murders. But about half of the murders in the first movie, you don't actually see them happen. You see the corpse afterwards sometimes, but a lot of them you don't see happen. There's admirable restraint there, like knowing, and that I think that's a great tribute to Sean S. Cunningham and Victor Miller and Tom Savini too, of knowing like when to go full out and show the gore, shove it right in your face, and then knowing when to pull back from it. Too, for effectiveness. I also feel so bad because Bill and Alice totally forget about Ned. Like earlier, like when it first starts to rain, like before they start playing the strip Monopoly, Alice is like, "Oh, Jack and Marcy are going to get soaked out there." They don't mention Ned. Ned's out there too. And then when they're searching, like, it's all about, "Oh, we got to find Jack and Marcy." They search Jack, Marcy in their cabins. What about Ned? And he's mentioned only one time when they're in the bathroom. Alice says, "Jack, Marcy." And then a little later says, "Neddy." That is the only time anyone ever mentions Ned again, which I think is interesting. I mean, it's probably just a script oversight. But for a character that was so prominent and vivid, again, the practical joker kind of thing, the fact that he's kind of forgotten in the script is, I don't know, just interesting. And we're really amping up for the finale now, you know, getting all the classic tropes in. We got a raging thunderstorm. They discover the phone lines are dead. The phone lines have been cut. The generator stops working, so everything is plunged in the dark. And the cars won't start, so they have no way of getting away. And it's Friday the 13th, and it's a full moon. And so we are all set up for the thrilling, bloody, action-packed conclusion of Friday the 13th. Steve Christie finally makes it back to Camp Crystal Lake, standing by the sign. Someone turns their flashlight on, and Steve says, "Oh, hi, what are you doing out in this mess?" And then again, the screen cuts away. We don't see what happens to Steve, but we can assume that he's dead now. But it's interesting, because whoever killed him is someone that he knows. All right. See you after the credits roll, my friends. I really love how quiet the scene is when Alice after Alice wakes up from her nightmare, noticeably screaming out Bill. It's interesting that, like, we know that there was something going on with her and Steve at the beginning of the movie, but throughout the film, you really see her and Bill start to have a really kind of sweet connection, like falling in love a bit. It's really lovely. But I love after she wakes up and then she goes to the kitchen and she's heating up the kettle. She's going to make some instant coffee for her and Bill. She has two cups, if you notice. It's so quiet. You just hear the heat on the stove, nothing else. It is so quiet for a really long time. It is literally the calm before the storm, before all hell breaks loose. I think it's such a smart moment. And after that scene ends, the music, these great music by Henry Manfredini, almost never stops. The character of Mrs. Voorhees comes in exactly 1 hour and 15 minutes into the movie, and she introduces herself to Alice and says, "I'm an old friend of the Christies," which again, Steve Christie seemed to know the person who killed him. Now we know why, that it's Mrs. Voorhees. I also love the detail that Mrs. Voorhees was the cook at Camp Crystal Lake. That was her job. And remember, Annie was going to be the cook at Camp Crystal Lake. And Annie is the first person that Mrs. Voorhees kills in our present timeline of 1979. Just an interesting echo. And also the fact that we find out that Mrs. Voorhees has been riding around with the corpse of Annie in her Jeep this entire time. All right, let's talk about Mrs. Voorhees, played by Betsy Palmer. First of all, Betsy Palmer was not the first choice for the role of Mrs. Voorhees. The first choice for this role was actually Estelle Parsons, because again, the director, Sean S. Cunningham, and the producers really, really wanted some Oscar winners in this movie. Estelle Parsons won Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in 1967 for her role in Bonnie and Clyde, and also is known to a lot of folks as the character Bev, the grandmother in the sitcom Roseanne. But very distinguished theater and film actor, has actually been the president of the Actors Studio in New York for years. She was offered the role of Mrs. Voorhees first. And my God, I would have loved to have seen it. Oh, she would have been so good. But she turned it down, and her agent said that they didn't know who in the world would do such a part. So after Estelle Parsons was out, next choice for the role of Mrs. Voorhees was Shelley Winters. Again, also associated with the Actors Studio, amazing theater, film, television actor, also on Roseanne as the great-grandmother. Also two-time Oscar winner for Best Supporting Actress. Shelley Winters also would have been amazing in the part of Mrs. Voorhees. She turned it down too. And then the role went to Betsy Palmer. Betsy Palmer, this was really against her type. Betsy Palmer did theater, film, television, was a panelist on the popular game show, the name of which escapes me now. I don't know why. But for years and years, and was very beloved, was known to be very wholesome. So in her roles. So the role of Mrs. Voorhees was a real departure for her. The only reason why Betsy Palmer did this movie is because she needed a new car. Her car had just died, broken down. She needed a new car. New car cost $10,000. She got the offer for Friday the 13th. And they are going to pay her $10,000 for 10 days of work. And that is why she did the movie. She did not have a high opinion of Friday the 13th. She got the script. She read it. And according to her, she said, "This is such a piece of shit, but nobody will ever see it." So she did the movie. But Betsy Palmer, like, you know, Estelle Parsons and Shelley Winters, was also, you know, a method actor. So she made up a whole backstory for Mrs. Voorhees, whose first name is Pamela, although that's not canon until the fourth movie. But her backstory for Mrs. Voorhees that she came up with was that you know, when she was a young girl, she had a boyfriend. They had sex before they were married. She got pregnant. The boyfriend left her. Her parents threw her out, so she had to look after her son, Jason, all alone. Got a job working at Camp Crystal Lake as the cook. Then her son drowned. And she then killed counselors and has sabotaged the camp ever since in revenge for her son's death. And also so that nothing bad will ever happen to anyone at Camp Crystal Lake again. So she came up with a whole backstory for it. And Betsy Palmer sells the shit out of Mrs. Voorhees. She is absolutely incredible in this film. And she's only in it for the last 15 minutes of it. And it's if Betsy Palmer was not as brilliant an actor as she is, I don't think this movie would work. Because, again, this movie kind of commits a cardinal sin in that the killer is someone that you have never seen before, a character you've never seen before, or has not been introduced. And in a mystery of who's the killer, whodunit, that's bad to do that. But it works in this movie because Betsy Palmer is so good. She, you know, is so warm. She's very warm in the very beginning when she first meets Alice, although you feel there's just a little something off. Like, why aren't you afraid to go into this cabin where there's dead bodies and a killer on the loose? That's weird. And then she is very moving when she tells the story of Jason and the death of her son. And then when she goes full on crazy, crazy killer psycho lady, she nails that too. In 15 minutes, she really creates a full-bodied character that you accept both like her pain and also that she's the scary crazy villain who has been killing people this whole time during this long night at Camp Blood. God love her. She's so, so good. And one thing I think is interesting. So she seems to become Jason, her son, at various points. Like Jason is speaking through her like, kill her, mommy, kill her. And my favorite line, which is kind of chilling, like, she can't hide, no place to hide. I wonder, like, is it just that she is crazy and is imagining that her son is speaking to her as part of her psychosis? Or is Jason's spirit actually present in some way, speaking through her? Is it Jason's spirit who is compelling her to kill and do these things? That's worth thinking about, considering where this movie goes, where the next movie goes. I don't know. It's never answered. And by the way, that line, killer mommy killer, was Henry Manfredini's inspiration for the now iconic part of the Friday the 13th soundtrack, which is in every single one of the movies, that you've been hearing in the interludes all this time. Manfredini took that line, killer mommy, and he took the first parts of those words and into a tape recorder, he did and then he ran it through a reverberation machine effect. And that's how we got that. That's where it comes from. It comes from Mrs. Voorhees, killer, or Jason speaking through her, killer mommy, kill her. The scene where Mrs. Voorhees slaps Alice. Betsy Palmer actually really slapped Adrian King, who plays Alice, the first take they're doing that scene. And Betsy Palmer subsequently said, well, in the theater, if you slap someone, you really slap them, which is not true today. This is before safe stage combat practices. So the very first time they did the scene, Betsy Palmer slapped Adrian King really hard. because she's doing it for real. She's a method actor. And Adrian King fell to the floor crying. He was like, she hit me. She hit me. And Sean S. Cunningham had to explain to Betsy Palmer that in movies, they don't actually hit people. They miss and use camera work. And finally, we have the end of Mrs. Voorhees. Alice decapitates her. And we see her head fly off. And there's the shot after the head goes off with Mrs. Voorhees' hands kind of reaching up into the air. And you'll notice that the hands are very big and that they have hairy knuckles. That's because that was not actually Betsy Palmer in that shot. That was actually the assistant to Tom Savini. But that's a fun little detail to rewind and notice. I really love in this movie, again, you know, because there's been a lot of talk over the years of the Friday the 13th series and slasher movies in general, especially in the 80s, being misogynistic against women. But I do find it really interesting in this film that, as many men die as women in the movie, and also that in the end, it comes down to Alice and Mrs. Voorhees. It's a battle to the death between these two, both very, very strong female characters, which doesn't quite happen again in this series. But I think, again, that's one of the things that makes the first Friday the 13th interesting. And then you have this idyllic shot of Alice on the lake in the canoe. It's finally morning. And the music for the first time is this really dreamy, beautiful, calming, serene kind of thing. As the police arrive, everything's going to be okay. Alice is going to be safe. And then you have Jace, little boy, zombie, whatever, Jason, jump out of the lake and grab Alice under. And that was not in the original script at all. But they realized in filming that they needed a final shock at the end of the movie. And that is what they came up with, was having the boy Jason come out of the water. And Betsy Palmer was not a fan of that when they told her. She was, because Jason was supposed to be dead. Like, that was the entire point of her character's motivation, is that Jason is dead. And if Jason is not dead, then what's he doing around? And we'll get more into that in the second movie. But they made Jason like this grotesque face. And Betsy Palmer saw the model and was like, why does my son look like that? And Tom Savini said, oh, he's a mongoloid. And she was like, what? She was not here for it at all. The original idea for the actor that was going to play young Jason coming out of the lake was actually Sean Cunningham's son, Noel. Sean wanted his own son to do it. But Sean Cunningham's wife was like, absolutely not. Like, you're not not doing it. And so the role went to an actor who had been in one of Sean Cunningham's previous wholesome kids sports movies, named Ari Lehman. Ari Lehman is the first actor to play Jason at the very end of Friday the 13th as a child. Ari Lehman also now has a punk rock / heavy metal band called First Jason, which I love. Then Alice wakes up in the hospital. It's like, yes, everyone's dead. And she's like, but what about the little boy? I'm like, we didn't find any boy. She says, then he's still there. And then we go back, dissolve to a shot of Camp Crystal Lake, and there's these little ripples happening on the lake. Maybe air bubbles for Jason. And then the end credits roll, and I love that the end credits continue the sort of beautiful, serene music. I think after this, you know, intense, bloody, long night at Camp Blood that we've experienced, I love that the music in the end credits is kind of purifying, sort of sends you out into a good experience. I love, if you can't tell, I love the first Friday the 13th. I really, really think It's great. I think it is I think it's underappreciated. I don't think it gets the credit that it deserves, really. And it certainly did not get the credit it deserved when it came out. It was hugely successful with audiences. It made a huge, huge amount of money, even though it was made very cheaply. But it made a lot. And so that was one of the reasons why I'd like, oh, we are doing a sequel to this for sure. But critics absolutely savaged this movie, hated it. And that brings me to a segment that we're going to do at the end of every episode of this season, called Bad Reviews, because the contemporaneous reviews for the Friday the 13th horror movies were so vitriolic. Like, critics were up in arms about these movies and how horrible they were and how they were destroying the youth of America. And they're really funny to read in retrospect. So just a few of them from the first Friday the 13th. So the Baltimore Evening Sun, in their review said Friday the 13th was a shamelessly bad film, but then Cunningham knows this. This is sad. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Friday the 13th is minimal on plot, suspense, and characterization. It is not very original or very scary, but it is very low budget. Ouch. This is a fun one. The Boston Globe, unless your idea of a good time is to watch a woman have her head split by an axe or a man stuck to a door with arrows, you should stay away from Friday the 13th. I bet that review got them so much business. That certainly would have made me want to go see it. I'm like, yes, I love it. Now, the biggest, and this will continue to be true, the biggest person who hated these movies were Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. And we're going to talk more about them, but like Gene Siskel, in his review of this movie, he obviously hated it, but he gave out the address of the producers. He gave the name of the town where Betsy Palmer lived, encouraging people to write to her. This would not be allowed today. But he also, in his review of Friday the 13th, spoiled the ending of the movie. He told people exactly what had happened, and hoped that they wouldn't go see it. Hated it. In Leonard Maltin, another very distinguished film critic, he wrote, and this will be the final one, in his book, Leonard Maltin's Guide to the Movies, he originally gave Friday the 13th 1 star, but then he changed his mind after the sequel came out and gave the first one 1.5 stars because it was slightly better than part 2. But this is what he has to say. Friday the 13th is a gory cardboard thriller. That younger viewers made it a box office juggernaut is one more clue as to why SAT scores keep declining. Still, any movie that spawns this many sequels must have done something right. And I agree. It did do something right, a lot of things right. And I hope you'll join me for the next 7 Friday nights as we go through this entire series. Join me next week, my friends, for Friday the 13th, Part 2. Until next time, pleasant dreams.